Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. Once again, I'm your host, Brian Moore. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, I am joined by Monty Hoover and Keith Smith to discuss healthcare planning, how they bridge gaps in healthcare planning, along with the changes and challenges they've seen over the last 40 years in healthcare. It's a fantastic conversation into the minds of two of the best planning strategists in the country. First, let me introduce our guests. Monty Hoover is a healthcare master planning strategist, principal, and architect at BSA Life Structures. A graduate of Ball State University, where he now teaches, Monty was president of the firm from 1994 to 2001 and chairman from 2002 to 2014, and has been with BSA for 40 years. Keith Smith is an architect, former director of architecture, former president of BSA, and was a member of the board of directors, where he held the roles of executive vice president and vice chairman for over a decade. He currently serves as principal in charge at BSA and Curis Design, a joint venture partnership between BSA, CSO, Ratio, for the design, planning, and project management of the IU Health new downtown hospital in Indianapolis, which is now under construction and will be completed in late 2027. Keith received both his Bachelor of Science in Architecture and his Master's in Architecture from the University of Michigan. Keith has also worked for BSA for his entire 40-year career.
Thanks to both of you for joining me on the podcast. Monty, I had a chance to speak with Keith in one of our first episodes, so he's given me a little bit of his background. But I always like to ask guests where their passion comes from and how you got started in healthcare planning and design.
Well, I will tell you that my first project out of Ball State in 1977 was to do a master facility plan for Methodist Hospital. That is now IU Health, and that is now the project that Keith is doing 50 years later. And then I went on to work at Humana, which was a for-profit healthcare company that owned over 100 hospitals. That gave me the perspective on healthcare planning from a business perspective. And I had a gentleman by the name of Joe Winnick, who was Senior VP of Healthcare Planning. And Joe taught me the nuances of how to right-size a hospital based upon clinical workloads. So that's really where my passion started.
And I'm going to ask both of you this. What trends that you faced early in your careers? And Keith, I'd like to start with you.
Sure. Thanks, Brian. First of all, I'd say learning the advanced skills of healthcare master planning and coming to understand how hospitals and health systems work took some time. I really have Monty to thank for giving me that opportunity to do that learning and mentoring me along that path. So that served me well over my career, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to publicly thank Monty for his help. I'd say once on the planning path professionally, I would say that keeping current on the ever-changing healthcare operational models, their associated performance metrics, and the reimbursement ramifications to planning solutions and recommendations was and continues to be a challenge as they are ever-changing. Knowing when planning rules of thumbs are sufficient and knowing when more in-depth analysis comes with experience. And then lastly, for this question, Brian, I would say that the system administrators and clinicians can have a different way of viewing planning needs and solutions. Understanding what their priorities are and what their evaluation bias is helps bridge what could be a communication gap between the planning or design team and the health system or the clinical leadership. Luckily today, BSA has clinicians on staff to aid in the planning and design process, but keeps any potential gaps in communication to a minimum.
Monty, how about you? What are some of the things that you faced and some challenges or trends?
The challenges in the 70s and 80s, I would say certificate of need, CONs, were much more prevalent. It's been phased out of many, many, many of the states here since that point in time. But to justify the need for more inpatient beds or clinical services, it was much more challenging because of certificate of need. It was a very data-driven process to support a planning and design project. Square foot per bed was an important metric back then. Some states even required legal testimony of the proposed space program and planning and design of the project in order to gain approval of the project.
Really? You had to give
so
legal testimony?
Yes. I've testified in Texas. Illinois, to this day, still has a health facility planning board that requires approval of projects. So that's a very data-driven process in order to justify that. The whole point of certificate of need was to try to control cost within healthcare, but the reimbursement model has changed since the early days. So CONs have gone by the wayside. There's a few states that still have those, but it was a challenging piece early on in our career to be able to justify a project.
That sounds like it. I mean, that's a lot of steps to go through, right?
Yeah. Well, and a lot of money for whether you were an independent hospital or a hospital system to go through the CON process to get that done.
Which is ironic because the point was to keep the costs lower.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you've got to spend all this money.
So you always had an attorney next to you
and
when you
have to pay him.
That process. But, you know, early on in my career, I used to help write certificate of needs. It was part of the services that we provided. And back working for Humana, where we had 100 hospitals early in my career, we were submitting a lot of certificate of needs around the country.
Bonnie's correct. Years ago, I had a client that was a national client and ended up having to be, as they call it, an expert witness in the CON proceedings. So you find yourself on the witness stand.
I mean, geez, yeah.
Judge.
Like a criminal trial or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I was doing that down in Alabama and Florida. But, you know, being on the witness stand was certainly nothing I was prepared to do by architecture school.
Right. Right. Sure. They didn't cover that, did they?
We did not get trained for that in architecture school. So it was part of the process of healthcare planning back in the 70s and 80s.
So how did you prepare for that when you had to go on the witness stand?
Well, you assumed they were going to ask you questions relative to facts about the project. Okay. So every state had criteria by which to support a project, and so you were speaking to that criteria.
Okay.
And like I say, some of those metrics, like square foot per bed, were part of the criteria. So, you know, even to this day, I spew metrics all the time.
And you've just memorized them, right?
And I've been trained over the years to understand metrics and how they get applied within healthcare. They're kind of more rules of thumb today, but back then, they were criteria that you had to abide by as part of your project development.
At least the proceedings I was in, you really had two jobs when you're on the witness stand. The first one was to prove why you're, because by that stage, you've already designed a facility. And so has the competition. And so as each expert witness takes the stand, you work to prove that your solution is the best. And then you work to prove that the others are not as good. And I don't want to say, I want to use the word attacking, but criticizing other architects' work I found pretty difficult.
Oh, yeah. And terribly uncomfortable in that setting, right?
Exactly.
So how did it work at the end? Sorry, I'm stuck on this.
So what happened?
Judge make a ruling then? Is that how they decide if you're up against another architect?
Either the judge or some people have a planning review board that would make that judgment. But usually, if anyone contested your, it was usually a competing health system. So the point is that you couldn't come into a health system's market and put in a new facility and compete against them unless there was enough population and the demographics would have supported the expanded healthcare within the community. So it's usually it was inpatient beds was always one of the biggies that everybody was trying to track. And, you know, even to this day, and, you know, how many beds are within a marketplace is still a criteria that people look at. So for us, you know, even here in Indiana, the Indiana Hospital Association, they kind of track beds in the marketplace. So what is the need for inpatient beds in the marketplace? And that's a strategic level of planning that goes on,
right?
But it's supported with facility planning along the way.
Interesting. I guess to piggyback off that, Monty, how did the healthcare industry's needs and priorities differ then from today's landscape?
Well, you could see back then that competition was an important factor. And, you know, it's a little more collaborative and let the free market work today. But I would say, and this is something that's impacted the healthcare architecture business over the years, and that's reimbursement. And the federal government reimbursement for Medicare and Medicaid is very impactful to our clients out there. So in the early days, back in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of cost-based reimbursement that was factored off of square footage in different departments of the hospital. So we were always tracking square footage by department, and the hospitals and the healthcare systems, they would submit that to CMS. And they still do that today, but back in the early days, reimbursement was factored off of that square footage. So there was some interest to try to, for the business model, if you could grow your beds, you were growing your revenue. So that went into the planning along the way. Whereas today, I would say we want to be more efficient with our square footage.
Right.
Because building is an overhead cost today, and the reimbursement is different. So less square foot per bed is better now than what it used to be. So reimbursement has always impacted our business. And in the good years is when reimbursement was flowing well through the government. In the bad years was when the government decided they wanted to change reimbursement, so everything would go on hold. So you always had to pay attention to what was happening with reimbursement from the federal government standpoint.
Let's turn and talk a little bit about technological advancements and how has the integration of technology shaped the way healthcare facilities are designed and planned. And Keith, I'd like to direct that to you first.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
Of course, the advancements in clinical diagnostic equipment continue to come at an increasing rate of speed. Knowing how to optimize the potential of this equipment is really the challenge. How much space, the environmental requirements, how the clinician prefers to use the equipment, and understanding how one particular piece of equipment fits within the overall care model are all components that help to optimize the healing capabilities of that equipment. Another technological advancement that people have spent quite a bit of time talking about, really the fully integrated electronic medical record. And that's been a long time coming to market, to be honest. The record itself isn't so much an issue on facility planning, but the associated hardware, both wired and wireless, do have requirements that need to be addressed in the planning and the design phases of projects. Utilizing this technology and placing it appropriately for the caregiver just helps to aid patient care.
Okay.
And so much of what we do is really enabling others to do what they do best, specifically those caregivers, because ultimately we're trying to, through the technology and the facility that's planned, you know, ultimately what gets given to the patient, it's really what we're trying to help.
Right.
And then I would also say, you know, the computer itself has had a lot to do with the planning and design process. There's always been an art to planning and design, even with the computer. And computer's just a tool. And it's not just as simple as loading data into a computer and hitting the enter button for an answer. Really searching for optimal solutions at times can be a lot of trial and error. I think it'll be interesting to see what AI brings to healthcare providers and planning and design firms, see what kind of change and what that does to increase the speed of the planning process. But a lot of that's still to be determined.
I know, it's just sitting out there, right? And it's like
right.
A daily, weekly, monthly thing with AI. Monty, I'd like to ask you kind of the same question, see what thoughts you have on it about.
I'm going to piggyback a little bit on what some of what Keith has said, but we'd like to say that design has driven innovation in healthcare, but technology is a major, major driver of innovation in healthcare, and it's made healthcare delivery more efficient, and it's also made it safer, which is important as well. Keith mentioned the electronic health record. That's been a big change. I'd like to say the patient bed, the evolution of the patient bed,
yeah,
and the safety features and the control features to the patient have been huge. And Hillrom, one of the major suppliers of patient beds in the country, is here down the road from us and always has been a strategic partner of our firm along the way. I would say patient monitoring and where we've gone from a lot of hardwire monitoring to wireless.
Mm.
Within the OR environment, the ceiling environment in the ORs has changed immensely. The use of majority of projects with booms to supply the OR environment and robotics within the OR have been big advancements. And Keith mentioned imaging. Imaging equipment is always changing, and it's usually the last piece of equipment to be procured on a project.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, there's the RSNA convention after Thanksgiving in Chicago, and they always bring out the latest advancements of imaging, and everybody wants to buy,
yep,
the most recent advancements of imaging. So it's always the last piece of equipment to go in, and it's, in many instances, the hardest to coordinate. And then lastly, I would say door hardware and security systems. The door hardware changes are immense that have gone into healthcare systems, and literally almost every door today has become some kind of electronic door.
Like a fob. Yeah.
And how you hard for that system, and then the whole aspect of security and security systems are important within the healthcare environment today, not only for safety of the patients, but safety of the staff. I think it will become even more wireless. That's
kind of
a hardwired component right now, but in the next 5 years, there'll be ways to manage that on the wireless. The security aspect of the door kind of goes hand in hand with all the electronics that goes with the door. So
then to follow up on that, how do you change the way that you design and plan as these advancements have made through? Like, draw me a parallel.
Well, I would say the biggest change is literally every floor or every department now gets an IT room. And
in the past, what, one?
Because, well, you might have had one somewhere in a building that could go within 300 foot for the wiring.
Okay.
But we don't even use that metric anymore. The metric is how you're serving a particular department. And in some facilities, it's not even one IT room, it's two. One for the hospital itself and one for a vendor to access the IT room. So as our healthcare facilities have become more smart hospitals with digital capabilities, the IT room for servers has become an important part of the component. So it gets built into your space programs. Anytime you're doing remodeling or an expansion project, you're probably thinking about, well, where am I going to put a new IT room for servers to manage that? So as all the electronics get built up in the hospital, you have the need for more of those server rooms to provide services.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So to expand on one point that Bonnie made, he talked about imaging equipment. I think what we're finding now is that a lot of technologies are being blended. Specifically, I'm thinking about, I guess to explain this by example, like a hybrid OR room.
Okay.
Where there's an MRI that either sits in an adjacent room or becomes part of the operating room.
Mm-hmm.
So that during a procedure, they can access that technology to
immediately
and to, you know, again, patient outcomes are what it's all about, right?
Right.
So I think we're going to see some more of that as time goes on, but it does, you know, our subject here is planning, and that it takes a unique, you have to pay attention to the space requirements. You have to pay attention to how staff and patients access those rooms.
Right.
There's a lot of safety concerns around an MRI and, of course, an operating room itself. And so, you know, having the experience to understand all that and work through that is important for a client.
Right. That's a really good point.
I'll add to that that, you know, we've always had engineering as part of our front services here over the years, but all of the computerization and digitalization of the hospital, we've brought on the skill set for low voltage engineers that are very much a part of the design process today. And I can tell you, I sat in construction meetings every week, and the one person that's always on the phone is the low voltage engineer because we're coordinating door hardware.
Let's change gears. What has been the shift towards patient-centered design, and how has that influenced healthcare planning, Monty?
Well, patient-centered design, I would say, isn't totally new, but the whole, what I would describe as the visioning process to develop a project's guiding design principles have created added value to the design solutions. And that visioning process creates design drivers. And a few examples of a design driver are patient and staff experience, where we're always trying to give control to one's experience for the patient and the staff. Another design driver is health and well-being with the type of environments that we're trying to create. Sustainability is another design driver. We want to be good stewards of our resources out there. And identity, where there's a sense of community with a hospital and a hospital's brand's values. So we're trying to bring all of those into the design process. So, you know, patient-centered design kind of implies patient first, but we give equal weight to the caregiver and the provider as we do to the patient as we're planning and designing facilities out there. But the whole visioning process is where you're trying to get feedback from patients and staff to develop those design drivers on every one of your projects. So a good project is one that has a strong vision and has strong guiding principles, because you can always revert back to those when you need to make a tough decision, whether to spend money on something or not.
How do you go about getting patient feedback?
Well, there's always patient focus group, at least within hospital settings, there is for that. And other times, you are actually engaging with some patients to get that kind of feedback. But you rely on users a lot, the staff, to help provide that because they see it every day. And then we're always searching for satisfaction scores that help advise us. So the HCAHPS scores that the federal government tracks. For many years, we had a strategic partnership with Press Ganey, who is a satisfaction survey company in South Bend, Indiana. And they used to provide us feedback from different hospitals where they would have had good scores from a satisfaction standpoint. We would then go research where they were, why they got those scores, and then we would apply that to our design. So that's kind of part of our approach to evidence-based design, was we were working closely with Press Ganey to be able to get that information. Now, most hospitals have some kind of satisfaction score company that they're working with, and they can provide you with that data. So they're, if they're trying to improve their scores in a particular arena, it'll show up in their scores. But the public and any designer can go to pull up HCAHPS scores, and you can view HCAHPS scores for a hospital.
Interesting.
It tells you something.
Yeah. So that's a nice segue then, Keith, to you've got this patient feedback, user feedback. How have facilities evolved to prioritize patient experience and comfort once you get some of that feedback and information?
Sure, Brian. Newer facilities have given patients much more control over their inpatient bedded environment, whether it is lighting level, sometimes even the color of the lighting itself, room temperature, interaction with their caregiver, and ease of access to entertainment and education sources are all examples of environmental improvements now available at the bedside. And Monty's previously mentioned the role of the bed itself.
Right.
And that plays an integral part of what I'm talking about here. Providing more amenities for family members are important as well. Family members play a key role in patient care. I think the statistics show out that if your family member is active in your care, chances are your length of stay is reduced.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Right. Aids in the healing process. Providing a way for family to spend a night in the patient's room, providing a way for them to work when necessary during extended visits helps make their time in the patient room more enjoyable. Of course, everyone likes a high level of interior design that complements all the other amenities. In today's competitive environment between different health systems, because people do have choices in many of our communities, patients and families really no longer tolerate bare bones in the facilities. Let's talk about wayfinding for a second.
Yeah.
Clear wayfinding makes the patient experience much more straightforward, thereby reducing potential frustration and stress. Clear signage and pathways that starts when your vehicle enters the health campus, continues to parking, the building entry, and then continues to the waiting areas and the treatment areas just makes the process much easier to navigate, more efficient. And I think patients and visitors really appreciate
that. Yeah, and I talked to Terry Joy about this when she was on the show, and the statistics of if you lose people in parking, you're likely to never recover from their experience in the hospital, even though that is just the intro point, you know? So the wayfinding, you know, I think we all would get frustrated. If you go on vacation, you can't find where the pool is because there's no signage or anything like that. So these make a lot of sense for sure.
Right. And you've hit on my next point, meaning everybody hates hunting for a parking space.
Right.
And some clients are considering technology that some airports and theme parks have had for many years. This technology helps guide you to an available parking spot, thereby eliminating that long search process of just driving around and hoping, right?
Well, and if you're going to a hospital, you've already got a lot of other things on your mind. So if you're getting stressed out trying to find a parking space, it's not going to help the experience at all.
And there are some folks, I mean, you want to talk about the future a little bit. Some clients are thinking about facial recognition that notifies your caregiver of your arrival, either on site or in the facility. That coordinates with your registration process. It even coordinates with some medical files.
That would be really cool.
So it's out there. Monty's talked about door hardware a lot, and I'd like to touch on that a little bit more, because a lot of that is about security. And security is a large concern at health facilities today for the purpose of maintaining safe care environments, not just for the patients, but for staff.
Right.
Everybody wants the added security, but nobody really wants to see all the physical elements of the increased security. As such, you know, technology that is, if you will, quote unquote, invisible or more integrated into the physical environment goes a long way towards accomplishing both goals. One example would be metal scanners that are an integral part of passageways that provide safety professionals the monitoring they need without slowing down the process of the caregiving process or the access to patient treatment. And it also eliminates that kind of that negative visual, very restrictive, that nobody really wants to see.
So these would be hidden.
And I touched on this before when we talked about family and visitors, but, you know, the amenities today for patient, family, and visitors have become very important. You know, food service options from the health system or an outside vendor really provide not only a necessary function, but they also offer a much-needed mental break to the facility visitors.
Right.
You know, a lot of times what's going on in these facilities is very stressful, and people need to get away.
Right.
Have some positive mental health time. Food service is only one example, but generally amenities within healthcare environments have become very similar to what is customary in the hospitality industry.
Oh, yeah.
And I would think that trend continues.
Monty, how have factors like privacy, accessibility, and healing environments evolved and been incorporated into what we're calling modern healthcare design? And I know you started to touch on a couple of these, but I was just curious if there's any more.
Well, a couple of simple ones over the years. We've moved to an environment where we want 100% of the inpatient rooms to be private and no more semi-privates. I mean, that's been kind of a mission I've been on for the last 25 years to get rid of all the semi-private rooms, which quite frankly, from a planning perspective, is not real easy to do because you don't generate any more revenue. Right. So you have to build more rooms, but your revenue off of a patient bed is not increasing at all. So it's not an easy sell from a healthcare planning standpoint. And then the other thing I would say is using rooms and holding areas versus cubicle bays. It's been a goal to eliminate cubicle curtains, no more cubicle curtains. They're an infection control problem, but they don't improve acoustics. So one of the biggest non-satisfiers in healthcare sometimes, in addition to parking, is the acoustics and the noise within hospitals. So we're always trying to eliminate all of the beeps and the alarms and everything else that goes on. So improving acoustics and improving infection control are a part of that. But I would also say that today, facilities are more ADA compliant than what they were before. Restroom facilities are ADA compliant. We're better at accommodating patients of size or individuals of size, and that's not only patients, but it could be a visitor as well. So how we create environments that accommodate that. So there's usually wider door openings for access than what there used to be. You know, we don't use a lot of 36-inch doors anymore because some wheelchairs don't go through it, and sometimes people don't go through it very well. So we're using wider door openings. And we're always trying to create healing environments. And for designers, that's a big aspect of what you're doing from a design perspective. You're trying to make people aware of access to daylight. Daylight is a good healer. Everybody knows that. It's been proven. So trying to create daylight within a facility is important. Outdoor healing gardens, green roofs are more prevalent. Better lighting that helps the healing environment quite a bit. And soft colors. We might have been devoid of using colors in spaces years ago, but we're using color, but they're soft colors and they're warm and healing type colors. So it's all aspects of design that gets integrated into the facilities today.
Keith, Monty had touched on sustainability a little bit and in a previous response. How has sustainability and resilience become a key consideration in healthcare planning and design?
Well, let's start with the sustainability piece. Healthcare providers have really accepted the social responsibility of caring for our environment. As such, you know, low carbon materials or sustainable construction processes are a lot of what we see being discussed and utilized in projects. Certainly recycling, quality of the physical environment, both the air and the waters, biophilia to aid in the healing process, are all improvements that many healthcare providers are willing to fund for the sake of improved patient and staff environments, as well as being a good citizen in their community. To the resilience part of your question, Brian, you know, every health system is concerned with increasing costs in all areas of their business, as we all are.
Right. Costs are going up everywhere.
Exactly. You know, the changing requirements and the associated necessary renovations seem to be inevitable for healthcare facilities. Codes change, technology changes, processes change. It always seems like even though you do your best at the original design, changes come down the way. So planning and design decisions that seek to limit the cost of future renovations are one avenue for helping to control cost. Universal design that will accommodate a wide range of clinical needs as opposed to a highly customized design solution is one example.
Okay.
Another example would be a physical structure and the associated mechanical electrical systems that have adequate capacity to accommodate change. They anticipate change without being modified in every renovation project. Thereby really the most expensive infrastructure components that have been adequately sized at the outset don't have to be changed, and that helps keep renovation costs low as well. Energy costs continue to escalate. Every client that I know of is interested in investing in MEP systems that will show a relatively quick payback and continue to provide energy savings for many years, which directly translates into an improved bottom line for them financially.
Yeah. Let's stay with that energy efficiency. Monty, can you share some strategies and techniques that you've implored to create energy efficient and environmentally friendly healthcare facilities?
Well, Keith mentioned on it, MEP systems and products are a big component of infrastructure that we're looking at. We've introduced geothermal into the whole spectrum of MEP systems in a healthcare environment nowadays, which we know is more sustainable and energy efficient. I would say interior finishes and furniture, how those products are being developed. There's a sustainability factor to every one of those. We pay attention quite a bit to building orientation and energy modeling. We're energy modeling every project that we do. And, you know, just the simple technique, if you live in a northern climate, you want that front door facing south so that the good old sun is going to melt the snow and ice away from the front door of the building, and you don't want to place that on the north side of the building. So it's simple building orientation is always very helpful when you're trying to deal with energy and energy modeling.
Yeah, and even windows, right? Which east, west, the sun sets, rises, which it's hitting different windows. It could heat up different areas of the building, right?
Yeah, so you're paying attention to all that as you're developing your design in the process. So,
Lonnie, how many planning projects have you done in your career? And how many of those do you feel like have bridged the gap between a master plan and an individual project? So, meaning how have you been able to examine a master plan, because I know you've done a ton of those, and then bridge the gap with another plan?
Well, I've been blessed. I've done probably over 50 master facility plans around the country with various healthcare systems. I'm currently involved with a academic medical center in upstate New York, a hospital in Baltimore, a healthcare system in Kansas City, and those have been longstanding relationships as an example. But the goal in developing a master plan is always to advise them on how to spend their capital dollars wisely each fiscal year into the future. So we're developing that roadmap for them. In each instance, we're addressing strategies and facility needs for maybe up to a 5-year or even a 10-year period of time. And we bridge the gap in design with space programs that could evolve from the master facility plan, concept diagrams, test fits, and certainly FGI compliance issues that they need to be aware of. So every master facility plan, if you're going to implement a key project component of it, we recommend going into a pre-design phase before you even hit a schematic design phase. And in that pre-design, that's where you are doing the space program, you're doing the concept development, you're doing a test fit, and you're making sure you got your FGI compliance in place. So that's how you're creating a roadmap for the future. I would say that master facility planning, it's not just architectural planning, but it's strategic facility planning, that it addresses the facility needs, it addresses the operational needs, the infrastructure needs, and the medical equipment needs from a capital spending plan standpoint going forward for a system or for an individual hospital.
Brian, I'd like to add one thing. And I don't have quite as much planning experience as Monty does.
How many have you done, Keith? I don't want to leave you out.
I don't think I've done a number. I don't know what the exact number is, but it's probably less than Monty's 50. But my point is, you know, Monty has taught me, Dick Sobre, one of the founders of BSA, has taught me, Don Altmaier, another long-term mentor of mine over the years, always taught me and others to take the client's best interest at heart. So my point is, you know, Monty gets phone calls, I get phone calls, many people at BSA get phone calls, and a client asks you to study an issue. It may be a rather finite issue, if you will. I think BSA does a good job of this. I know Monty does a good job of this. You know, really, we try to take a long-term view of how we answer those questions. And you're not, maybe you answer their question for the short term and you solve that problem, but you always try to solve the problem that sets them up for long-term success. Recently, I had a client call me up asking to add one OR in their surgical suite. I took some time to study that, found a way to rearrange and optimize their surgical suite, and over time, they'll be able to add a number of ORs within that department, and they'll be able to delay what would probably be a future major expansion.
Right.
Maybe that's not very smart business-wise.
But it was the right thing to do.
But I think you always get rewarded when you do the right thing for the client.
So last question for both of you, and I know it's hard to predict the future, but based on your experience, where do you see future trends and challenges in healthcare planning and design? And Keith, I'll start with you.
Well, I think the system consolidation will continue in that process. I think that will continue across the country. As such, it will be necessary to provide integrated system solutions when we're doing planning for patient care. And it's not, again, not just for the individual facility, but we have to take the entire health system into account as to how everything relates to each other. And make sure that if we're just studying one little area, it does fit their entire operation. You know, again, setting people up for success in the long term. I think hospitals and hospital campuses will be more focused on centralized chronic disease treatment. I think the less chronic care will be in multidisciplinary, decentralized facilities that leverages technology that may be in your home, might be in your pocket, might be on your wrist. I think those decentralized facilities will also be focused on education and maintaining wellness, not just disease treatment for the populations they serve. Many healthcare providers look beyond their own four walls and consider how community health can be improved with things like recreation facilities, adequate quality food providers, many things that are responsible, if you will, for the greater community, not just limited to the health facility.
Yeah.
And as such, you know, key healthcare facilities, like an academic healthcare campus, becomes a catalyst to urban renewal and improvement to community health overall. I also believe that mental health care will become more readily available and take a more prominent place in the overall care of patients.
That's a good point. Really good point. Monty, do you have anything to add to that from your standpoint?
Well, it's hard to predict the future.
Right.
When I'm mentoring people around the office, I use a little quote. I say, you don't know what you don't know. So ask questions and get peer reviews done. Because, you know, there can be old people like me that, you know, I've learned my lesson. I've done something wrong along the way. And we can always advise you as to what's right and what's wrong. So it's hard for young designers not to understand that you don't know what you don't know, because there's a lot to learn in healthcare. So I'm close to retirement, so maybe the next generation is best to answer that question.
Yeah.
But I can say this, healthcare is constantly changing. I've been at it for almost 50 years. I do think the one new thing that will evolve as I become more of a user of the healthcare system, I think hospital at home will become more prevalent. And exactly what that means is yet to be defined, but certainly trying to get to more convenient access to healthcare delivery. I'm a firm believer that when I need to become a heavy user of the healthcare system, that my smartphone and my smartwatch will be my first access to healthcare delivery.
Yeah.
And the sooner we get there, the better, because it's right for us to do that. And then you won't have to worry as much about those parking issues.
Right.
And I will say, I laughed one time. A CFO told me that a good day for her is when she did not get a parking complaint. And that's a CFO that right. said that.
Right.
So you can see how the evolution of hospital at home can add great value to providing services and healthcare as we go forward in the future.
That was great. Well, thank you both for coming on. This has been an awesome conversation, and look forward to a future one as well.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Wow, it's amazing to hear from two legends like Monty and Keith talk about planning and master planning healthcare facilities. Thanks again to both Monty and Keith for joining us on this episode of BSA by Design. If you're interested in learning more about planning or about BSA Life Structures, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. You can subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And we've got more content to share throughout social media platforms, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.